You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 7th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
Presidents Joe Biden and Xi Jinping plan to meet, or at least sit in front of laptops at the same time. New York's public library system writes off the fines incurred by generations of late-returning scofflaws. And happy birthday, Vladimir Putin. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily, in association with Allianz, starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Isabel Hilton and Mark Galliotti will discuss all the day's big stories. Plus, we'll hear from London Mayor Sadiq Khan, and we'll have Henry Rees Sheridan's latest letter from New York City. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is The Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Isabel Hilton, founder of China Dialogue, and by Mark Galliotti, principal director at MIAC Intelligence. Hello to you both.
Hello there.
Good evening.
Mark, seeing as how you are here in person this time, we can plug a thing that you are in the next issue of Monocle magazine. You participated in the second installment of our new feature, The Debate. Both of us spoke to Leonard Volkov and Ekaterina Khodrakadze about Russia and why it doesn't basically just, I don't know, get with the program.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, you know, we've agreed that Russia is a place unto itself.
Very, very, very tactfully put, almost as if you hope to get a visa to go back there one day. Isabel, you have recently been visiting Sweden?
I have. Giddy excitement. My first trip beyond the borders of the United Kingdom for nearly 2 years because of one thing and another. and very nice it was too. Stockholm, I can proudly report, is still there and seems to be thriving.
Well, that is an exciting dispatch from the world out there. Did it seem weird being able to do that as well? Because I haven't actually left London at all since this thing started, and I'm hoping to do that one day soon. Is it something you just felt able to slot back into? Oh, yeah, this is a thing that happened. Or did you find yourself going, what is this mighty airborne steel horse, etc.?
A little bit more like that, I think. It all felt quite off balance, to be honest. And there's, of course, a massive paperwork and testing that you have to do, or did have to do, I think, this week. That's lightened up a bit. So you're kind of partly trying to satisfy all these new bureaucratic demands, and then just the unfamiliarity of going to an airport and getting on this implausible metal tube that will never get off the ground, as we know. It's all very curious.
Well, if there's one thing I do enjoy, it is bureaucracy. So that's something for me to look forward to. But let us turn to the top of tonight's agenda, which is a summit meeting between the leaders of the United States of America and the People's Republic of China. This is, of course, usually one of your full-dressed diplomatic wingdings, with presidential planes, motorcades, red carpets, furled flags, and minutely choreographed bonhomie. Before the end of this year, we're going to find out if it all seems quite as big a whoop when it's a Zoom call. The two current inhabitants of those two roles, Joe Biden and Xi Jinping, have agreed in principle to a virtual summit. Isabel, is a virtual summit really a summit?
Well, at least they're talking. Although, actually, they've talked on the phone, so it does feel a little kind of summit light. But Xi Jinping hasn't actually left China for more than 600 days. I mean, since January of 2020, he hasn't gone anywhere. And he does seem to be extremely nervous about traveling and quite worried about, I think, about COVID. So he hasn't turned up at the UN. He's probably not going to come to COP26. He just hasn't been in person at any of the big meetings. So I guess what it does signal is that the United States and China are conspicuously talking, which can't be a bad thing given the state of tensions. And we might hope that they might advance, you know, some cooperation and lower the tensions a bit.
Mark, we will get to what they're going to talk about, but I do want to talk about this idea of a virtual summit. As an observer of the diplomatic circuit, are you worried that opportunities might get missed here? Because that is the thing about summits. facts, isn't it? It's all the stuff that goes on inside meetings, random conversations, people getting to know each other and ideally even perhaps to like each other. That's not really going to be possible on a Zoom call, is it?
There is a degree to which, unfortunately, by doing it virtually, you get all the bad stuff, which is the tedious reading of the agreed communiques and such like, without any of the potential good stuff, which is precisely tends to be in the margins. And often it's not even actually about the principles themselves. It's about their inner team of fixers and advisors who actually can get together, and whether it's over a cup of tea or a beer, or even just simply daggers drawn, but nonetheless can get that kind of personal relationship. And it's quite interesting, actually, if one looks at, for example, the snap response from the Russian press. And when I say Russian press, I'm clearly talking about what they are being fed by the Russian Foreign Ministry. It's two things. One of them is Putin got to meet Biden in person. There is clearly an element of one-upmanship there. But it is also actually a sense that, and obviously they have a reason to be more dismissive of it, because as far as they're concerned, it's actually quite advantageous to them for China and America not to be getting on, because it gives them a degree of sort of movement in between. But they are also suggesting, actually, are these things that much worth it?
Isabel, that does bring us to what they do have to talk about. And there is not, of course, any shortage of subjects where the US and China is concerned. There never is. But what do they most urgently need to get to grips with, do you think?
Well, actually, quite a lot of conversations have been going on at sub-presidential level. So we had trade talks this week. Jake Sullivan, the security honcho, met Yang Jiechi, his Chinese counterpart. The last time they met was in Alaska, you may remember, and they pretty much tore each other to pieces. So this is an advance. They described the talks this week as cordial. The big issue this week is Taiwan, but whether that's amenable to a conversation between Biden and Xi Jinping is another matter. I guess the next big issue might be the origins of the COVID pandemic. But again, I don't think China's going to give much on that. On Biden's agenda will be trade. He hasn't budged much on the Trump agenda there. And the signs are that at least the United States isn't going to make it worse, but it's not going to make it much better. And beyond that, human rights concerns in Xinjiang and Hong Kong. I think the list is fairly well known.
Well, indeed. And on the Taiwan one in particular, Mark, is there actually much point in them discussing it? Because everybody who is party to the Taiwan thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it strikes me that everyone is being very careful not to say anything definitive, because a certain amount of ambiguity kind of works for everybody, doesn't it?
It does. But I think there is also, first of all, a ritual element, is that there are certain things if you don't do, people will read into that. And that's why, again, so many of these gatherings, the majority of the agenda, one pretty much knows not just a week in advance, but one could guess 6 months in advance, because exactly they are the usual things. And again, the real value is in the extra stuff or in the slight nuance, the particular language that is used that then gets interpreted and so forth. So ambiguity is a good thing up to a point. But the real problem with ambiguity is that it doesn't lock anyone into any position. But also, there is always the risk that it leaves the other side uncertain about exactly what is going on while they believe they know it. And so, I mean, again, I mean, obviously, I'll be curious to hear what Isabel feels about this, because exactly, I think this is the point about we've seen often with the Russo-American relationship, is actually you can talk to people from DC, and as far as they're concerned, they have telegraphed exactly what their position is, where their red lines are. And likewise, you will go and talk to people in Moscow, and as far as they're concerned, they know exactly what the American position is. The problem is that they are telling you two rather different things.
Is there a case of that going on where Taiwan is concerned, Isabel? Because it is one of those things where the United States always makes broadly supportive noises of Taiwan, obviously short of recognizing it as a sovereign state or anything. But the United States is certainly never said anything even remotely to the effect of we would defend Taiwan to the last man and the last dollar.
Absolutely. And actually, that's the structural ambiguity, if you like, in the Taiwan situation, that the United States is committed by treaty to supply Taiwan with the means of its own defense. But as you say, has never pledged or said publicly that it would come to the defense of Taiwan in the event of a Chinese attack. However, that doubt about whether it might is a restraining factor, undoubtedly, for the PLA. And I guess the risk of miscalculation, which I think we're beginning to see in China, is the assumption that the United States is weaker than it actually is. I think there has been, the Chinese have been telling themselves lately that the US is in terminal decline, that the Chinese system is prevailing, and that the Chinese system is superior, and so on. And I think it's quite easy to overestimate the degree of the United States' decline. And certainly, there are big problems in the United States, and it's international posture has changed a lot, but it's still a very powerful country and one that you mess with really at your peril. So I think the risk of assuming that the United States has simply left the scene is that's a factor I would be worried about.
Mark, final thought on this one. Isabel mentioned, of course, the human rights questions that may well get raised in these discussions. And China, like Russia, has... It recently had a four-year holiday from being lectured on human rights by the United States, while the President of the United States was someone who clearly could not have cared less. But does the fact that we now have a President of the United States who will at least say the things that a President of the United States is supposed to say about this stuff, does it make any difference? Is there anything Joe Biden could possibly say to Xi Jinping about, for example, the Uyghurs of Xinjiang that would alter China's behaviour towards them in the slightest?
Well, I'd be very surprised, I mean, unless he becomes much, much more robust than we've been sort of getting the hints of so far. Because, again, if one looks at his relationship with Putin, again, there was an element of a certain ritual raising of the case of Alexei Navalny, the poison protester and so forth. It was got out of the way pretty damn quickly, though. And it was more than made up for by some warm words about two great nations, huge responsibilities to the world and so forth, which actually, in diplomatic terms, was very, very productive, because this is one of the things that Putin has craved, is that sense of acceptance, that sense of legitimacy in the eyes of the West. So the problem is this, it's always going to be a trade-off. It's absolutely, if you want to raise these issues, which countries like China, like Russia, will essentially regard as domestic issues, part of their own national sovereignty, you can, but it's very hard to know actually what traction you've got, and it's going to basically cast a shadow over the much, much more pragmatic relationships that you're probably trying to develop at the same time.
Well, let's move on somewhat, although not all that much, because the question raised is what birthday gift do you get the man who has everything? An Arctic naval fleet, apparently, in what is probably a coincidence, but Russia is an increasingly odd country, the 69th birthday of President Vladimir Putin has coincided with the announcement of plans to inaugurate a new fleet of the Russian Navy with responsibility for the country's chillier maritime interests. It is not known yet what other celebrations are planned by Putin, though previous years have involved recurring themes such as hiking in Siberia and playing in ice hockey games against obliging and or terrified opponents. 6 years ago, Putin ran in 7 goals in one such fixture. Mark, let us consider the serious aspect of this first of all, which is the Arctic fleet. Is that going to be that big a deal? I mean, it's not like Russia doesn't already have ships and submarines operating in that vicinity.
Yes, there's no real suggestion that this involves more ships. It's just simply a resubordination of existing Northern Fleet assets to create an Arctic fleet. And in that respect, this is more than anything else a political statement on two flanks. One is it could potentially have something to do with Putin's birthday. It's worth noting, after all, that Minister of Defense Shoigu, the man who precisely takes him on these brotastic hiking trips through Siberia, knows very well, it seems, how to play the president. And exactly, there could be an element of happy birthday, Mr. President, here. But more seriously, it is symbolic about precisely stating something that we've seen in a whole variety of other government statements and actions, which is that Russia is reorienting itself as an Arctic nation. And this shouldn't necessarily be seen always in aggressive terms. It's about the fact that as the Arctic waters, the northern waters, open up more and more for trade because of global warming, well, the Russians are presenting themselves as the stewards of this region. So if one looks, for example, at the new slew of naval bases that are being built along the long, long Arctic coast, they're naval bases, but if you drill down, you see that a lot of it is search and rescue that they're building. So, I mean, in this respect, it's not so much saying we will crush anyone who challenges our claim to the Arctic. It's more just simply saying, remember, Russia is an Arctic power, and if you want to sail through it, one way or the other, you'll just have to be aware of Russia.
Isabel, a brand new Arctic fleet notwithstanding, Putin's 69th birthday is, of course, a reminder that he, like the rest of us, is getting no younger. And while he is in good nick for 69, and we will doubtless shortly have the shirtless horseback portraits to prove it, is this starting to become a concern for the Russian regime? The fact that these are not spring chickens so much anymore. This is Vladimir Putin and his cohorts are all becoming persons of a certain age, and they don't really seem to have gone out of their way to establish much in the way of succession plan.
Well, that's the problem with autocracies, that if you have a nominated successor, you pretty much have to kill him off, because you then spend your long winter nights worrying that he's mobilizing against you and trying to get you to leave the stage. And if you don't have one, you know, what happens when you do leave the stage is a worry for everybody else. And I think that, you know, given that the regime is not that popular anymore, and that Putin, you know, is holding it together by force of will and no doubt fear, I think that there is a lot to worry about. And if I were in Putin's circle, I would be concerned. I'd probably have my passport to hand and an open ticket on a flight, just in case, you know, one of those ice hockey games ended badly, or he, heaven forbid, fell through some melting ice in his next excursion to the Arctic.
Mark, this is something that comes up in that debate that we conducted for the magazine in the next issue on a newsstand near you reasonably shortly, I think. But is what we're witnessing in Russia now, is it basically the last desperate grasp of what you referred to in that debate as Homo Sovieticus, trying to hold on to some remnant of the glory days? Is what we have to do for Russia to become basically a relatively sane and normal European country just to wait these people out?
There is a considerable degree to which that's true, and it's a very unsatisfactory position, particularly from a policy point of view. But I think that is the biological reality. It's interesting because Putin is clearly not a man who trusts easily. And if one looks at his inner circle, and there are people he absolutely does trust, with the exception of this defense minister, Shoigu, who is a stripling at 66, essentially they are pretty much all in a band of 68 to 74 years old. They're all of the same generation. They went through the same experiences. Many of them were in the KGB, like Putin, and the others were from St. Petersburg or Leningrad, as was then. And in this respect, precisely because he hasn't been able and willing to find other people, younger people, in whom he can place his trust, he's having to rely on a kind of gerontocracy. And it's interesting that this year we've seen a selection of key figures, including his equivalent to a national security advisor, Nikolai Patrushev, about to reach 70, which in the old system was the hard cap for a civil servant. At 70, you had to leave. Well, lo and behold, what do we get? We get an amendment to the civil service law that says that if you have been appointed by the president, which happens to include the heads of all the security services, then you can actually stay after 70 if the president decides that exceptional circumstances apply. Patrushev has just hit his 70th birthday. No hint that he's going to be stepping down. So this is essentially Putin desperately hanging on to the people whom he knows. And it means that, yes, at some point there will be a transition. And if one looks at the people who are younger than him, I'm not saying they are nice people. I'm certainly not saying they're Democrats. They are essentially pragmatic kleptocrats, which from the West is okay in a way, because we know how to deal with pragmatic kleptocrats. As we've seen from the Pandora Papers, we do it all the time. But the key thing is that what they seem to lack is that visceral sense of anger, of betrayal, directed toward the West, that people in Putin's generation and cohort seem to feel. They absolutely feel that the West is actively planning to do Russia down. and that they are simply having to fight back because the West is duplicitous, the West is dangerous. The people below, they may not like the West, they don't plan to emulate the West, but frankly, they would be very happy to bank in the West.
Isabel, that generational split that we're discussing is significant, though, isn't it? Because that cohort that Mark is describing, these are people who had... they had adult lives and careers under the old system. That was how their understanding of the world was formed. I mean, there is that great wisdom that if you want to understand anybody, think about what their world was like when they were 20. And I think once you've got to that point in your life and beyond for somebody of, you know, 69 years old now, he was a well-established KGB officer when it all came tumbling down, you can't ever really cut yourself off from it, can you?
No, and I think particularly that KGB mentality formed in the Cold War, that's very, very, you know, it's a very formative experience. I think it's fascinating that there will be new generations of people in power in Russia who just don't have that, who see the world quite differently. But I think that actually in almost every institution in every country, you have a problem of people whose views were formed in their 20s and then have to cope with a changing world. And it doesn't always go well.
Indeed not. Isabel Hilton and Mark Galeotti, thank you both for the moment. You are listening to The Daily. We will have more from our panel shortly.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Conor Foran is an award-winning designer and the founder of Disfluent magazine, a publication that aims to recognise stammering as a strength and destigmatise it as a weakness. Conor and his colleagues are passionate about recognising disfluency as something to be proud of. Conor, it's great to talk with you. Tell us about Disfluent. Why did you start it and what's the concept?
Disfluent began as my college year kind of final year project. It's a short printed magazine about people who stammer. The interviews use a typeface called Disfluent Mono, which like emulates the voice of the speaker by repeating and stretching its letter forms. And the concept kind of came about by my own experience of stammering, where when I was younger, I didn't like know anyone else who stammered. And because of that, it is a very isolating experience. And I never really saw like anyone represented in media that had a stammer that I felt was maybe real. Because say if it's on TV or a movie, the person who stammers is like always a villain or maybe an idiotic kind of sidekick. And even worse, then there's these representations that will demand pity from the audience, with the person who stammers eventually kind of overcoming it. And I think it was these kind of narratives that I think are really bad and kind of damaging that inspired me to make a thing that's more kind of honest and that would portray those who stammer as normal kind of people, and yet the idea that a stammer and kind of other things like it are beautiful and interesting experiences in like their own right.
Conor Foran on unlocking, building and maintaining confidence today and tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Isabel Hilton and Mark Galeotti. Now, London is grappling with a rising number of rough sleepers and also with concerns around the safety of women following the abduction and murders of Sabina Nasser and Sarah Everard, the latter by a serving police officer. Earlier today, Monocle's Carlotta Ribello caught up with London's Mayor Sadiq Khan at an event to benefit the homeless to ask him about those issues.
We're doing lots of work in relation to dealing with the consequences of rough sleeping. So we're doing lots of work and making sure rough sleepers get off the streets, get the help they need, and stay off the streets. The problem is, as you said, the root cause is the pipeline that's leading to people becoming rough sleepers. So in the last 11 years, the numbers of rough sleepers in London has more than doubled, right? There's a reason for that: austerity, welfare benefit changes, and so forth. So although we've managed to get lots of rough sleepers off the streets, by the way, 86% of people we help stay off the streets. We have an in for good principle where we have wraparound support. The problem is the pipeline. And I worry with the cuts to universal credit, with the furlough scheme stopping, with the increase of prices of food and so forth, with a tax increase next March, April with national insurance, it's a perfect storm to see an increase in rough sleeping. And that's why we're lobbying the government in relation to give us help to have more affordable housing, more council housing. Don't cut the universal credits by £20 a week. Give people the support they need so they've got work, so they can be getting an income to pay rent rather than ending up on our streets. And also, we know many people across the country come to London when they have adverse consequences. We've got to try and help people at root where they are so they stop coming to London and becoming rough sleepers.
Now, of course, being the mayor of one of the biggest cities in the world comes with a lot of challenges. The question that everyone has been asking you is, of course, regarding the night tube. As you mentioned, you were the mayor who introduced that. What's your view on that, and is the trust in London broken?
Look, I think the confidence of people across the country has been shattered in the police service. We can't pretend it hasn't. The serious abduction, rape and murder by a serving police officer, he used his position to get her into his car, used his police-issued handcuffs, is shocking. Can't pretend it's not. I think the police, the government, myself, got to address that issue. But at the same time, we've got to do what we can to make meaningful change now. And so as far as public transport's concerned, we've got our buses running 24 hours a day, the night buses across London, CCTV and all the buses and staff. We've made sure that our tubes from central London go until 1 a.m. and start again at 5:30 a.m. We're to pause the night tube because of the pandemic, around on Friday night and Saturday night. It's personal to me because I introduced it. As soon as we're able to bring it back, we're going to bring it back. We've made sure we've now started training again new operators and staff, because many of them had to go to daytime services because of the pandemic, drivers catching the virus in the daytime services, having to self-isolate. We couldn't train new drivers because of the social distancing rules. I'm hoping to have a good news announcement in the next couple of weeks, because I understand why Londoners, particularly women and girls, want the night tube back.
That's Sadiq Khan, mayor of this city, talking to Carlotta Ribello, producer of this program. Back now to our panel, Isabel Hilton and Mark Galeotti. And exciting news now for any listeners who have borrowed something from one of New York's public libraries, which they have not quite gotten around to returning. You are officially off the hook. The New York library system has abolished the fees it charged on overdue items on pain of revoking access to libraries for those who failed to pay up. It is the latest of several American cities to have made such a move, and results elsewhere have been remarkable. Chicago saw an upsurge in library card renewals and an 83% increase in book returns. First of all, do either of you want to confess to having borrowed something from a library which you either held on to for an untoward amount of time or perchance have not yet returned?
Not guilty.
Not guilty? Mark,
to the best
you're looking
of my knowledge,
to the best of my knowledge.
Yes, quite.
Oh, dear. I think we all know what that euphemism is cloaking. But if you borrowed it from the New York Public Library, you're fine. You just need to get it back to them.
Except that what's the incentive to do so if simply, just simply now, it's essentially free and clear? I mean, it's interesting, because I must admit, I am, true to the academic stereotype, something of a library fascist. And my view is, in fact, heavy-booted librarians ought to be kicking down doors to get books back. But it does sound that, in fact, contrary to my authoritarian impulses, that this more liberal policy works.
It is counterintuitive, isn't it, Isabel? You would have thought if they were serious about it, then something along the lines of the public floggings, which I think Mark was on the verge of advocating there, might have a
that
more...
called Plan B.
might have a more invigorating effect on late returners, but this has apparently worked.
Well, to answer Mark's question about why would you return a book if there wasn't a fine, I want to bring to your attention a number of returned books which have been returned apparently out of bad conscience. The biggest library fine ever paid was $345.14, paid on a children's book which had been which was 21 years overdue from a library in Kansas. The apparently the most overdue library book in history was borrowed from Sydney Sussex College in 1668 and was returned 288 years later. No fine is recorded as having been levied. So really the jury's out on what works. But I think if people have a conscience about libraries, they sometimes return the book and enclose the fine at 2 cents a day. By the time it's built up to, you know, hundreds of dollars, it's been away quite a long time. And sometimes they just send the book back just to be free of the bad conscience.
Because, Mark, that's basically how libraries are supposed to work, isn't it? It is supposed to be a bargain struck with the conscientious citizen.
Well, it's not so much about the conscientious citizen. I mean, obviously, when you have a fine system, you are actually presuming that the citizen is a shiftless wastrel who, without some kind of penalty, will forget or not bother or just steal the book. And this, obviously, is a much more humanistic approach. And look, in fairness, I think, given that libraries are in trouble these days, anything that actually can make them once again more central, and with them that glory, which is actually the paper book, rather than the, and I say this as an e-reader myself, you know, but rather than just simply a collection of photons, there is something special about real paper books. And if this helps bring more people who otherwise might be sort of concerned about the financial costs to a library, good thing.
Isabel, is there still an extent to which libraries have to evolve to, I guess, excite people in a world in which so much is available without having to go to the library? I mean, I think I am old enough to remember trying to write a journalistic thing and needing to check a thing and therefore having to go to the library and borrow a book. Whereas now, of course, I can just open my laptop and in seconds have almost what is certainly the wrong information, but you know, it's right there. Have libraries properly got their heads around that yet? What is the purpose of them at a time in which most people can access really quite a lot without having to go to one?
I think it does come down to the books. I mean, look, libraries have evolved enormously. They have much better cataloguing systems. They have electronic resources available in libraries. You can go to a library and plug in not just to your dodgy information on Wikipedia, but to, you know, the whole academic networks if you want to. So there are enormous resources. But I think that in the end, if you become a librarian because you love books, and probably most librarians would rather not have to lend them out at all. I mean, the stories of the condition in which they are returned with, you know, fried eggs used as bookmarks are really horrendous. It must be heartbreaking for anyone who really cares about hard covers and paper.
It is my understanding that you are still expected by the City of New York to cough up for anything you just lose completely or in some way irrecoverably damaged. But we will move on now to an author about whom inquiries will have spiked at libraries around the world these last few hours. 2021's Nobel Prize for Literature has been awarded to the Tanzanian-born, UK-based novelist Abdulrazak Gurnah. The Swedish Academy praised what they described as his uncompromising and compassionate penetration of the effects of colonialism. Gurnah declared himself surprised and humbled at receiving the prize, and while this may well have been the case, it would be nice just once for a Nobel recipient to react by saying, "It's the least I deserve, sling it on the heap with the rest." Mark, is the Nobel Literature Prize, I mean, it's a big deal, obviously, in terms of the hefty check that comes with it, which I speak from bitter experience. I can confirm that any author would be massively grateful for. And obviously, there is a huge spike in publicity. But does it actually say anything definitive about the literary canon? Are you automatically a great writer if you're wearing one of these things?
Well, the answer is clearly not. In the sense that, obviously, culture, styles, fashion, tastes change over time. All it says is about a moment in time, about the here and now. And I think that's one of the reasons why this matters. Obviously, it matters a lot to the individuals concerned, and no doubt there'll be a run on his books, and good luck to him. But I think it also is a way of, in some ways, charting what matters to the presumed great and the good of the literary world in this one particular point. So I think it's as much as anything else just simply a statement of the times.
Is that what you think's going on here, Isabel? Is there an amount, and this is not necessarily to make any judgment on the doubtless considerable quality of Abdul Razak Gurnah's novels, that there's a bit of zeitgeist chasing going on here by the Academy? Obviously, themes around colonialism have been a huge part of the popular discourse, and probably not before time, the last couple of years or so. Is this an acknowledgement of that?
I think Mark's absolutely right. I think that's very much what's going on. And like you, I'm afraid I haven't had the pleasure of reading this laureate, and I look forward to it. But certainly there is an element of zeitgeist here. And actually, to be fair, the committee had said so. You know, they have looked at their list of past winners and noticed a remarkable tendency to award the prize to middle or late middle-aged men, white.
But being Swedish seems to be an advantage as well.
That does help. Yes, yes. I think of the laureates who essentially tossed it in the bin, Dylan comes closest. I don't think he turned up, did he, to his ceremony?
He did do some sort of somewhat bewildering gnomic acceptance speech.
but they are trying consciously to correct that rather narrow view, and this is, I mean, of all years, this is a topic that deserves attention. So I don't think that's a bad thing. I think, you know, a prize for literature needn't necessarily be a contest for you know, supreme literary merit. It can be about relevance. After all, literature is a very important way of opening up discussion that needs to be opened.
Just as a final thought on this, I do want to ask each of you in turn if there is anybody in particular who you think should have won this thing by now but hasn't. I'm always perpetually hoping they give it to Ismail Kader, the Albanian author, not just because I do enjoy his novels, but because I've interviewed him for, in fact, Monocle magazine, and I could therefore say I have interviewed Nobel Literature Laureate Ismail Kader. But anyway, there's always next year. Mark, anyone you can think of who's been scandalously overlooked at this point?
Well, the thing is that for work and in a professional term, I'm on the whole reading heavyweight scholarly stuff about Russia, and particularly about a lot of really nasty sides of Russia, since I work particularly on spookery and gangsterdom and such like. So when I'm reading fiction, I am a bear of astonishingly little brain, and I'm looking for diversion. So in some ways, it's just as well that I'm not on the Nobel Committee, or I'd probably be putting someone like Terry Pratchett forward.
I think there's a makeable case, and you can kind of imagine a year in which they decide to do that.
Yes, but I think at this stage, again, it would be this attempt, as you put it, at zeitgeist hunting rather than anything else. But, I mean, look, I think the point is, in some ways, it comes down to what is literature about. There are different notions. Is it about distraction and diversion? Is it about educating you in the great truths of the world? Or is it about, in some ways, trying to bring an educative function forward into actually stepping out of your own reality into others? All of these are perfectly valid. Maybe we need a whole bunch of different Nobels.
And Isabel, your pick?
Well, unfortunately, I think most of the people I like to win the Nobel Prize are dead, and so that rather rules them out. But I can tell you my favourite Nobel Prize for Literature story, which was told by Salman Rushdie, who was at a conference, and late one night there was a banging on the door, and it was one Jeffrey Archer, who came in with a
scandalously
bottle of wine, indeed, and said... sat down and said, "Now, tell me how you win the Nobel Prize for Literature." Sadly, whatever Salman Rushdie told him clearly hasn't worked yet.
I can imagine Salman Rushdie's response to Jeffrey Archer asking that question could either have been very long or very short. Isabel Hilton and Mark Galeotti, thank you both for joining us. Finally, on today's show, time for our semi-regular letter from New York City. This week, Henry Rhys Sheridan takes stock of some upcoming votes in the Empire State.
Political campaigning is in the air in New York. Democratic mayoral hopeful Eric Adams has released his first campaign video.
I'm Eric Adams. We have to invest in early childhood education, universal child care, and affordable housing.
So has his rival, Republican Curtis Sliwa.
Well, the choice is somebody up in the suites, like an Eric Adams, you know, professional politician, or somebody down in the streets and subways, that's Curtis Sliwa. I've got the touch with the common men and common women. I understand what their problems are, but I also understand how to fix those problems.
The mayoral vote is on November 2nd. But to be honest, the race isn't very exciting. That's because Adams is so heavily favoured to win. At this point, in order to lose the election, Adams would have to either commit a very bad crime or die. Or both, for example, in a badly botched bank robbery.
No!
But there's a more hotly contested race ramping up. And it's attracting more attention, even though the vote isn't happening until next November. That's the race to be governor of New York State.
In just 1 year, Governor Andrew Cuomo went from national hero for his handling of the pandemic to facing multiple investigations over allegations of harassment. If he runs for re-election one more time, he could be in for one tough fight.
According to the New York Times, current NYC Mayor Bill de Blasio has been telling people he wants to be the next governor.
Look what these women went through. They were put through hell by a very powerful man, 11 women, including a state trooper, harassed, in some cases assaulted, and he thought he could get away with it. If we were talking about his use of vaccines as a political tool, giving vaccines to allies, withholding them, I mean, it goes on and on and on. It's over, Joe. He has to leave. There's nowhere for him to turn.
De Blasio could run next year, after his term as mayor has ended. Becoming governor would probably make Bill de Blasio feel better than I've ever felt or ever will feel. Not only will he have won a coveted political office, he will also, in his mind, if not in reality, have taken it away from his nemesis, the former governor, Andrew Cuomo. By all accounts, Cuomo wanted a fourth term as governor more than anything else in the whole wide world. Well, perhaps he should have thought about that before he sexually harassed 11 women. He resigned in August, weeks after the release of an official report detailing his abuses.
In many ways, I see the world through the eyes of my daughters, Cara, Mariah, and Michaela. And I have lived this experience with and through them. I have sat on the couch with them, hearing the ugly accusations for weeks. I want them to know from the bottom of my heart that I never did and I never would intentionally disrespect a woman or treat any woman differently than I would want them treated. And that is the God's honest truth.
That report was overseen by New York Attorney General Letitia James, who looks likely to launch her own bid to become governor.
I'd like to address an issue that's been in the news over and over again. The independent investigation into allegations of harassment against Andrew Cuomo and the 168-page report on those allegations. Since that report came out, the former governor has spent a lot of energy criticizing it and me.
In order for de Blasio or James or anyone else to get their hands on the keys to the governor's mansion, they'll have to first beat the incumbent, Kathy Hochul. Hochul was Cuomo's deputy and took over from him after he resigned.
Well, you'll be coming into office under extraordinary circumstances. You've got a full plate, but one of the issues is going to greet you right at the door, which is this toxic...
Some senior Democrats, fearful of the damage a divisive gubernatorial primary could inflict on the party, are rallying around Hochul. On Monday, she won the endorsement of the chairman of the Democratic Committee in Suffolk County, Rich Schaefer. Schaefer seems to feel that Hochul is a safer bet for governor than Bill de Blasio. Of de Blasio's prospects, Schaefer has said that Osama bin Laden, is probably more popular in Suffolk County than Bill de Blasio. I searched for polls on Osama bin Laden's popularity in Suffolk County, but I couldn't find any. Bill de Blasio's latest approval rating as mayor of New York in June was 37%, which isn't very high. As I've mentioned, the vote is a long way off and a lot can happen in the meantime. But unless Eric Adams is overcome with late-onset manic kleptomania, it might just be the next most exciting election on New York's political horizon.
Henry Ree Sheraton maintaining there a remarkably even keel while also conducting a large jazz band. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our panellists today, Isabel Hilton and Mark Galliotti. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Monocle Media Summit is back. Join our editors for a look at the brands, correspondents, and titles that are shaping the media landscape and steering its future. This year, the event will also mark Monocle 24's 10th birthday, so we're putting a special focus on broadcast media. A packed afternoon of panels will once again be hosted by Monocle's founder Tyler Brulé and editor-in-chief Andrew Tuck, along with colleagues from print and radio. The session will feature insights from a stellar lineup of industry leaders, like CNN Chief International Correspondent Clarissa Ward, Bild-Zeitung's Deputy Editor and Chief International Reporter Paul Ronsheimer, Zeit Magazin's Christoph Ament, author and researcher Jess Henderson, Finnish TV anchor Matti Ronka, and his BBC TV and radio counterpart Michel Hussein. Plus, there's a chance to watch a special live broadcast of the Monocle Daily on location. And after that, you can meet and talk shop with the speakers and the Monocle crew over drinks. The Monocle Media Summit is taking place on Thursday, the 14th of October, at the Hyatt Regency London, the Churchill Hotel, W1. As a Monocle listener, you can get 10% off your ticket. Head to monocle.com now and enter the promo code M24Birthday. We look forward to seeing you there.